طفلة تمتطي قوس قزح، طفلة تمتطي.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly broadcast of news, analysis, commentary, and discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's continuing occupation and colonization of their homeland. This program features the Palestinian narrative from a perspective we do not get from the mainstream media. This Week in Palestine was created by Sharif Pham and is continued in his memory. This is your host, John Roberts. This morning we feature excerpts from the Left Forum, which was held in New York City this past May of 2016 at the John Jay College. In particular, we focus on a panel on Israel-Palestine moderated by Paul Jay of the Real News Network out of Baltimore with Tariq Ali and Norman Finkelstein. Once again, we are unable to cover the complete panel in one broadcast, and so we'll feature the Left Forum panel this week and next on This Week in Palestine. We begin with the introduction of the panel by Paul Jay, who will introduce Tariq Ali and Norman Finkelstein.
Prime Minister Netanyahu, recently appointed, as I'm sure most people know, Avigdor Lieberman as his defense minister. He seemed very unconcerned how this might affect American public opinion or how it might affect a $10 billion weapons package that's being negotiated. And why should he be concerned? The American media is the one that delivers this news to the American people and continues the narrative that Israel is the victim in all of this, so of course they need $10 billion of weapons. It is highly likely that either Secretary Clinton or Donald Trump is going to be the next president. We know that Secretary Clinton's record has been very close to AIPAC and is very much an ally in terms of their objectives. Donald Trump was recently endorsed by Sheldon Adelson. It's clear he has now shown exactly what type of negotiation he plans around the Middle East because he has to fund his election campaign, and we will expect similar policies from him as regards the Middle East. The point here is that it's an extremely dangerous moment for the Palestinian people. The need for a South African-style broad front solidarity movement against Israeli occupation in support of the Palestinian people is even more urgent. So that's what I hope we end up discussing today, how to develop that broad front so we leave here with something to do about it. But in order to get into that conversation, first some background from our two guests who are eminently qualified to give us such background. First of all, next to me, Norman Finkelstein. He's one of the foremost scholars of Israeli-Palestinian conflict. He's written about a dozen books on many topics, including U.S. foreign policy towards Israel, the use and abuse of the history of the Holocaust, and Gandhi's philosophy of nonviolence. His controversial legacy as an academic was made into an award-winning documentary film, American Radical, The Trials of Norman Finkelstein. His latest book is Method and Madness, The Hidden Story of Israel's Assault on Gaza. Tariq Ali, on my right, is a writer and filmmaker. He's written more than two dozen books on world history and politics and several novels, translated into over a dozen languages, as well as scripts for the stage and screen. He's editor of New Left Review and contributes to The Guardian, Counterpunch, the London Review of Books. His latest book is The Extreme Center, A Warning. And thank you and help me welcome them. So my first question is for Tariq, and the format's going to be, I'm going to ask some questions, our guests are going to give long answers, I hope, and then there will be some time at the end for some Q&A from the audience. Tariq, it was a few weeks ago an Israeli general compared the fascistization of Israeli society to 1930s Nazi Germany. Talk about that process.
Well, it's good that it came from the mouth of an Israeli general, because if any of us had said it, we'd have been accused of being anti-Semitic or self-hating Jews or whatever other names they call those who criticize Israel rationally. The fact that it was the general, the deputy commander-in-chief of the Israeli Defense Force, who said it, did create a certain propaganda crisis for them. He was denounced by Netanyahu himself, but I think the words got home. People began to think that the situation in Israel is getting worse and worse. And this came after a number of events in Israel. The arrest of a soldier for killing a Palestinian, mass mobilizations in favor of that soldier, support for that soldier from many elements within Likud and the extreme right in Israeli politics, the fact that within Israel itself, the Palestinians are no longer regarded by a vast majority, not just by a small extremist minority, but by a large majority of the population as something not worth bothering about. And it's this that is worrying certain people inside the Israeli establishment itself. I don't know how many of you saw a documentary some years ago called The Gatekeepers, which was statements by people out of power, when it's much easier to say these things, about how every single Israeli policy in relation to the Palestinians had been a disaster or had failed, and how they had done bad things. This is a serving general inside the Israeli army who is saying this, and it's already, I think, partially. Netanyahu wanted to punish him by openly speculating that he was going to appoint Lieberman defense minister, i.e. putting this extremely nutty semi-fascist in charge of the Israeli Defense Force, and the serving defense minister has now resigned, saying that this is unacceptable. These are all people inside Likud or on its fringes. So what this indicates to me is, you know, that it's not just that the occupation of Palestine has been horrific for the Palestinian people, but we now have very clear evidence that the occupation of Palestinian lands by the Israeli establishment and by all political parties in power since 1948 is proving to be extremely bad for a majority of Israelis as well, even though they don't seem to recognize the fact just yet. But some of the more intelligent elements inside the Israeli establishment do recognize it and feel unless some stop is put to this, it's going to end badly.
Norman, is it this volume okay? Avigdor Lieberman is someone who actually proposed ethnic cleansing of Palestinians from Israel. He actually redrew the map and was taking Palestinian villages and areas and putting them into occupied territories, taking back land. It was straightforward ethnic cleansing. Why do you think it is that Netanyahu is so confident of his position that the appointment of Lieberman isn't going to affect the arms deal and generally affect his the positioning right now in terms of the elections?
I think one has to begin with the fact that coming next year, we'll be hitting the 50th anniversary of the Israeli occupation of the West Bank, Gaza, and West Bank including East Jerusalem and Gaza. That means, roughly speaking, two and a half generations of Israelis have lived with, and not just lived with, but been active participations in the occupation. And the bottom line is, Israel is a small place. Its population now, I saw the most recent statistic, is about 8.3 million people, which is roughly the size of New York. And the population under occupation is about 4 million people. In order to occupy such a large number of people, relatively speaking, to your own population, even with the Palestinian Authority, it still requires virtually, if not literally, aside from those who are allowed to skip army service for religious reasons, it's virtually every single Israeli at this point has been an active participation in a quite brutal occupation. If you look at the histories now written, even the torture of Palestinians, the use of torture against Palestinian detainees, it begins right after the occupation begins. It then reaches a peak during the First Intifada, when Human Rights Watch estimated that tens of thousands of Palestinian detainees were tortured or suffered ill treatment. And leaving aside the torture, the demolition of homes, which was quite pervasive up until a Supreme Court decision, which to some extent diminished it, the point is that a large part of Israeli society has been and had to be, given the roles they were playing, had to be brutalized and to some extent, no, to a large extent, inured to the kinds of brutality they were visiting on the Palestinian population. If you don't understand that and you detach Israeli society from what goes on at the leadership level, then you really don't, I think, understand what's going on. Because it's a whole society with a certain small number of exceptions, and even the exceptions will emphasize that they are exceptions. It's a whole society that's just gone over the cliff. If you want to understand Israeli society, the easiest way to grasp it is to look at the documentaries of our own civil rights movement and look at the folks, the white folks in the American South. It's that kind of brutalization that's occurred across Israeli society. And that's unusual. Now, it's no doubt true, the United States as a state, as a government, it engages in mass atrocities and brutalities across the planet. But it's a relatively small number of Americans who are actual participants in those acts. That's not true in Israel. Even if you take a figure who's very popular in the United States, he's a kind of strange version of what we used to call a court Jew, namely Jeffrey Goldberg. He plays this kind of strange court Jew, tough Jew role. He never quite sure knows what role to play in order to get his cachet into the White House. But if you take a person like Jeffrey Goldberg, who's a mainstream American figure, and in the media he's looked upon as some sort of representative of American Jewry at its proudest moment. If you read his memoir, Prisoners, he was a prison guard, and he was part of the conveyor belt of torture. He was freely admitting to it. He would bring prisoners to what was called the refrigerator. It's the size of a refrigerator where they put people in for a couple of days. You can use your imagination. Even people like Jeffrey Goldberg, who was a volunteer from the United States, he himself became part of the conveyor belt. And so it's a whole society, including Jeffrey Goldberg, as an example, including American Jews who went over, who brutalized and then became inured to that brutality. And so for Israelis, doesn't really make much difference what maniac happens to be in power. If you look at all of the Israeli assaults on Gaza during Defensive Shield in 2002 in the West Bank, in Lebanon, if you look at the public opinion polls, in every single case, at least 92%, and sometimes as high as 95% of the Israeli population supported those assaults. Basically, they were just massacres. There was, except for the case of Lebanon, there was no war to speak of. And that enjoyed overwhelming support. Now, if you look in the last couple of days, who are the people in Israeli society who are, quote-unquote, sounding the warning about the potential fascistization of Israeli society? Let's leave aside for a moment the deputy commander, whose background I'm not familiar with. The most prominent person right now is the ex-defense minister, Ya'alon. Now, he quit, he said, because of disturbing tendencies in Israeli society, doesn't want to be part of them. Who was Ya'alon? Ya'alon was the defense minister during Operation Protective Edge. Now, if you read Aluf Ben, who's the senior military correspondent for Haaretz, he says, why was Ya'alon shook up? What shook him up? He said, in 2015, when the Duma family child, the one-year-old, was torched, he was very upset. And then the turning point for him was the killing of the wounded Palestinian by the Israeli soldier. What happened during Protective Edge? 550 children were killed, not one. If you read the descriptions in like the UN report on Gaza, which was a dreadful report, it was presided over by a New York State judge, Mary McGowan Davis. You can fill in the rest, you can figure it out. The kids, their body parts were flung everywhere. Children, they have an arm on one roof, an arm on another roof, torsos which couldn't be identified. 19,000 homes were destroyed. But let's be clear, it wasn't destruction as in quote-unquote collateral damage. If you read the Breaking the Silence testimonies, they talk about they went into areas, marked off the areas, systematically laid waste, razed the homes. Now, you know here, like myself, if your computer overloads, or even in my case last night, my keyboard wasn't working, I enter into a panic. I call up everyone I know in the earliest hours of the morning. We have a crisis. There's a crisis. My keyboard doesn't work. But then, Gaza consists 80% of refugees and children and descendants of refugees. Over 50% are children. And now you have this army of Israeli citizens. It's like everyone in this room at a slightly younger age. Everyone in this room, these are ordinary people. Do you know what it means to destroy someone's home? You go into the bedroom, you see the kids' playthings, you go into the closets, the drawers. You know what it takes, the kind of mentality it requires to do that? And that explains why Israel has, in my opinion, has gone over the cliff. The idea that Ya'alon would be traumatized by the killing of one kid, or even take the next one who's traumatized. We read today, Ehud Barak is traumatized. He thinks there are ugly tendencies at play. Ehud Barak, it's already forgotten. This whole cycle, the whole cycle of the last 16 years, it began with him, with the fake claim that he made a big offer at Camp David, which was then endorsed by that monster who happens to be married to the other monster. And actually, it convinced a lot of Israelis. I know many Israelis who were completely convinced that a great offer was given them, the Palestinians. They turned it down. There's no one to negotiate with. What was the next thing Ehud Barak did? On September 29th, 2000, the Second Intifada began. He was the one that gave the order, it has to be mercilessly crushed immediately. For those whose memories go back, before the suicide bombers, the suicide bombing didn't begin until March 2nd, 2001. The actual First Intifada, it began on September 29th, 2000. 5 months elapsed before that first suicide bombing. Who created that situation? It was Barak. Within 3 to 4 days, 3 to 4 days, 1 million, 1 million rounds of ammunition were fired at the Palestinians. As one Israeli put it, one for every Palestinian child. That was Barak. And it was because of him, the Second Intifada, for those who remember before the suicide bombings, because that's all we're told about. The Second Intifada started out nonviolently. It was the same mass demonstrations as in the First Intifada. But then with the brutality, the ratio was 20 Palestinians killed for each Israeli killed in the first 3 weeks. It was just a bloodletting. So when I hear Barak and Ya'alon are worried by this sudden appearance in Israeli society of fascism, you have to take it with a big boulder of salt. On the other hand, but I'm going to stop here because Paul said you can answer at length. I was once told when I was debating in Canada, they said the wrong thing to a Brooklyn Jew. They said, be aggressive. I don't want to tell you what happened.
Okay, I was in Beirut in 2012, and I interviewed a young girl. She was about 14, 15 years old, in a Palestinian refugee camp. And I asked her, what would you say to Israeli kids your own age? She said, I'd like to strangle them with my bare hands around their neck. And I said, why? And she said, because I saw on Israeli television when they were bombing Gaza, kids were writing their names on the bombs about to be dropped.
Whoa.
And that mainstream Israeli TV showing this. So this hatred, this the anger in these kids for what they've experienced, lived, and witnessed, and seen, does not seem right now to have a way to express itself in a way that's going to be liberating for the Palestinian people. So where are we at in terms of the response of Palestinians now?
Well, I think if we are brutally honest, we have to say that the Palestinian organizations, especially the Palestinian Liberation Organization, which negotiated the Oslo Accords, has participated and collaborated in the defeat that has been inflicted on the Palestinian people.
They want you to hold the mic a little higher.
I think this collaboration was absolutely vital for the Israelis in order to do what they are now doing. And I think the debate and discussion that has now opened up, even within the PLO, is an indication that everyone now knows, there's no secret, not that they didn't know it before, that this is the way they were going. And for a long time it was difficult to say it. I mean, I've been saying it for 10, 15 years in different parts of the world, including at conferences organized by Palestinians themselves. And in private, a lot of them would agree, you're right, but we can't say it in public. I said, you have to say it in public. It shouldn't be left to people like me to say it. You have to say it. Because saying it will be helpful and will not allow the people to get too demoralized. If no one opens their mouths from within the leadership or lower echelons or lower ranking cadres of that organization, we're sunk. And in fact, as we know, the scale of the collaboration was huge. Of the money given to the Palestinian, so-called Palestinian Authority, which was Palestinian but which had no authority at all, because never was there a Palestinian Authority. From the beginning, the real authority was the IDF, and behind it the Israeli government, and behind it the White House and the State Department, i.e. the United States of America. So there was never any Palestinian authority. What they had was a budget. Billions came in. A majority segment of this budget was spent on what? Security. Security, let's see what is meant by security. Defending the Palestinian people against the onslaughts of the IDF? No, perish the thought. The security they talked about was to keep their own people under control and to deal with rival factions of Palestinians in Gaza, etc. That's what the bulk of the money was spent on. Where did some of the rest of the money go? It went in enriching those who would organizing this so-called Palestinian Authority. Political leaders, including right at the very top, low-level cadres, they were bought off and told, we've struggled enough, let's enjoy life for a bit. But you know, we're all in favor of enjoying life for a bit if your own people aren't living in such dire and desperate conditions. And this is what was completely ignored. And, you know, I have a very dear friend, a Palestinian poet who lives in Cairo, who told me when I went to Ramallah, a close friend of mine, we had fought together in the old days, took me up the mountain and showed me his brand new villa, which must have cost, God knows, you know, $500,000 or the equivalent thereof. And he said, look, this is how I live now, and I'm happy. And he said, I felt like slapping his face. because not so far away were people who were living in really appalling conditions. And this money, which could have been used to aid every Palestinian family, to build schools, to build small clinics, etc., etc., was frittered away. And the Israelis knew what they were doing. They were buying off the top layers of Palestinian society within the PLO, and we have now reached a situation where I was at a conference in Spain, in Cordoba, a few weeks ago, sharing a platform with the Palestinian Minister for Finance and Economics, and everything I've said to you, I said to his face. And he admitted, he said, yeah, perhaps we spent too much on security. And I said, what about the $2 billion bribe scandal? And he said, that's exaggerated. No open denial. It's a huge tragedy that the leaders of a movement could be bought off and bought off so easily. So he then turned to me and said, well, what would you do? I said, for one thing, what I would do now, really, because enough is enough, is say to the world at large, there is no authority, there is no Palestinian authority, we are going to dump it, it doesn't exist, we are just Palestinians in this region which is occupied by Israel, and dear world and dear people in the world, that's what we are. Are you going to help us? Please do. If not, we'll struggle on and live together and share each other's goods and money as long as we can, because that is what is needed. And he said, well, there's a logic in what you say. But I said, the logic, if it exists for you, has come too bloody late for the Palestinian people. They know what you've done. The Israelis do horrific things, as Norman has eloquently described and has been describing for years. But I said, being defeated by your own leadership is psychologically and politically very damning. That is much more difficult to get over, because you then say, what alternative do we have? Where are we going? So I say that as long as this is recognized, and they are beginning to recognize it, it's difficult not to, that they have lost the battle for a Palestinian state. That Palestinian state which they dreamed of, even on the 67 frontiers, is not going to happen, because the occupation settlements have just encroached too far into Palestinian territory. There is no Israeli government which is going to remove them, because it won't have the support of its own population to do so. The United States is indifferent, always has been indifferent to the fate of the Palestinians, and more so after the 67 war. So there's going to be no help from the so-called international community, by which is just a code word for referring to the United States. There's no such thing as an international community. So in this situation, far better that the Palestinians acknowledge of their situation and then see how to proceed forward. The situation is grim. It's pointless prettifying it or finding hope in tiny things. Not that these tiny things are not important. The BDS campaign is important. It's important not because it'll bring down the Israeli government. That is an illusion, that it will bring down the Israeli government. The South African government was not brought down by sanctions. It was brought down by the defeat inflicted by the Cuban army on South Africa. But sanctions on their own are never decisive. I nonetheless support them. Why? Because it is an important way to project what is going on in the Israel-Palestine, the world of Israel and Palestine, and in the world at large, and on that front it's been effective. The reason the Israeli government is so hostile to it is not that they feel threatened by the sanctions, but because it disgraces them. It shames them. They have to answer questions about it. When campuses in the United States or parts of Europe stand up and say, we demand a boycott of Israel, it shames even the American government, which finds this horrifying, and European governments, which have done absolutely nothing to aid the Palestinians. So these movements, societal movements from below, are extremely important from that particular vantage point, and that's why I was a signatory to them, to it, from the beginning, without any illusions, but understanding its importance. And this is why now there's a huge campaign. They've outlawed BDS in France, which, by the way, is the most pro-Israeli country in Europe today. And the appointment of Mark Negev, a friend of Netanyahu's and formerly Netanyahu's press officer, who you probably saw complacent and unctuous on television screens defending the indefensible, is now the ambassador in London to see if he can persuade the Conservative government to do what the French have done and make BDS activities illegal. And allied to this comes a new campaign, which is not new, of course, in the United States, but is new in large parts of Europe, whereby the chief rabbi in Britain said there is no such thing as anti-Zionism that is not also anti-Semitism. Actually said this, and said that anti-Zionism, people who talk about anti-Zionism, are anti-Semitic. Of course, liberal Jews and the Jewish Voices for Peace, thankfully there are many more of these still in British society than the other, came out very strongly denouncing this. So there is a debate going on, and you ask yourself, why is it that suddenly this campaign of anti-Semitism got sparked off in Britain? That's because the Labour Party, to its own horror and shock, has elected a leader who is very well known for being a defender of the Palestinian cause and the Palestinian movement. And it is this that has panicked them. So they are denouncing people in his circles, etc. Sometimes Ken Livingstone, the former mayor of London, says something which is three quarters accurate but not 100%, and says it in a temper without rationally arguing it. So they pounce on him. Or another member of parliament who 2 years ago forwarded one of Norm's texts and satirical blogs, satire is fatal these days, satirical blogs saying that all the Israeli Jews could of course come back and live in the United States if they want to, since many of them went from Brooklyn and so whatever. So this is so obviously a satirical blog, and she found it amusing and forwarded it. She's been accused of anti-Semitism because she was foolish. Instead of saying this is a blog by Norman Finkelstein, I forwarded, then they could deal with Norman directly. But instead, she panicked and apologized and went on her knees. They've still suspended her from the Labour Party. Because the worst thing to do in these situations is not to fight back. If you don't fight back, they carry on and on and on. So this is what's going on. And you know, the irony of the situation is that if you want to know the community in Europe which is really suffering, it is the Muslim community. Yeah. There is a huge wave of Islamophobia in many parts of Europe. I would say virtually all of Europe, which in its manifestations is not that different from the attacks that were made on Jewish people in the 20s and 30s and even in the 40s and even in the 50s after the Second World War. A lot of the arguments being used against Muslims are very similar. Someone has actually done an analysis of what was written about the Jews and what is being written about the Muslims. Almost exactly the same. And yet, does anyone care? No, well, we do. But by and large, this is completely ignored because the media is a part of it. So that is the situation that we confront. And of course, you know, we fight it back. But the Palestinians have to understand, and I think increasingly they do, that the state they visualized is impossible. So the only hope, I can't see any other way out, is a solution which many staunch Israeli anti-Zionists from the Matzpen group and others have defended for a long time. And many of them educated me in this whole idea about 40 years ago, that the only viable long-term solution is a single Israeli-Palestinian state with equal rights for Jews, Muslims, Christians, Palestinians, Druids, whatever.
You are listening to a recording of a panel on Palestine-Israel at the Left Forum held in New York City in May of 2016. We continue with a follow-up question answered by Norman Finkelstein dealing with the settlements and BDS.
The question was, why not, instead of the blockade, focus on the settlements? The answer is a little bit complicated, not complicated, but you have to think it through. The blockade, the settlements, there is a strong argument. They are illegal under international law. That's the opinion of the International Court of Justice, all the major human rights organizations, and so forth. So there's a solid phalanx of mainstream public opinion, including, I should also add, the UN Security Council, which has declared the settlements illegal. The main manifestation of the settlements right now, the main manifestation is the wall that Israel has been building in the occupied West Bank. It consumes about 10% of the West Bank, including the critical water resources and some of the best land in the West Bank. The International Court of Justice ruled in July 2004. It said, number one, the wall is illegal. Number two, the wall has to be dismantled. Israel has to dismantle the wall. And number three, if Israel doesn't dismantle the wall, then there's an obligation on the part of the international community to see that the wall is dismantled. That makes it a very tempting target, the wall. The problem is, in the case of the West Bank, between Israel and the Palestinians, there's both the wall and the Palestinian Authority. There is a political wall and there's a physical wall. At this point, I see no evidence in the occupied West Bank of any kind of movement that would have sufficient potential and power to break through both the political wall of the Palestinian Authority and the physical wall that has been created. Though, again, objectively, there's a real possibility there. Because when you evaluate these things, when you try to assess what's possible and what's not possible, in my opinion, the most important thing to look at is, where is public opinion? Where is progressive public opinion? Sometimes I use the expression, what is the political horizon of progressive public opinion? If you want to know the political horizon of progressive public opinion, you look at the mainstream human rights organizations. What have they said? You look at the International Court of Justice. What has it said? You look at the UN General Assembly. What has it said? Those are fairly decent indicators of where the political horizon of public opinion is. And there you have a good case for targeting the wall, but you also have a good case for targeting the blockade, because all the mainstream human rights organizations have declared that the blockade is illegal because it's a form of collective punishment. The whole of, as I said, now reaches even to Bernie Sanders, who says the blockade has to be lifted. The difference is Hamas itself wants to lift the blockade. They're not doing much about it, and I think their strategy is wrong-headed, but at least the political leadership is committed to it. In the West Bank, there's no political leadership that's even formally committed to bringing down the wall. Now, having said that and trying to fully answer your question, there's a kind of paradox in the BDS movement between what they actually do and what their platform says. There's a chasm. A chasm may be a strong word. Let's just call it a distance that separates the two. If you look at the actual BDS resolutions, say on college campuses, I like to do homework even when Paul told me I don't have to prepare for this. I still have this need to prepare. It goes back to when I was in grade school. I was a nerd. Always had to prepare. And last night, I did take the trouble to go through all the BDS victories for the year 2015, which are listed on their website. And then I proceeded to go to each school which passed a resolution, and the resolution calling for divestment. In virtually every single case for the year 2015, there were 8 victories, I think. In every single case, it targeted the settlements. In fact, in a couple of cases, it explicitly said in the resolution that was passed, we are not BDS. We have nothing to do with BDS. Because they recognize the platform itself, it may be, and in my opinion, it is legally correct. Implementation of the right of return of the Palestinian refugees, full citizenship rights of Palestinians living in Israel, and ending the occupation. That is legally correct. But I said earlier, politics is not just about what's legally right. You have to look at where public opinion is. And BDS activists who are committed, conscientious, give it their all, and are really impressive. The victories have been impressive. But they recognize the limits of public opinion. You can't get a resolution passed if you start calling for full implementation of the right of return. They focus on the settlements. We mentioned earlier, and I'm glad to hear, that Tariq and I agree on the spectacular achievement of the Bernie Sanders campaign. It had to be spectacular. Because last night I gave my 4th contribution. Now, anyone who knows me, that's more than pulling teeth. The moment I read Bernie's campaign, it's down to $5.8 million. He needs money. I want him to win California. I'd also like to see Paul Krugman drop dead, but we need that as well. That's unrelated. But if somebody will if somebody puts something on the website to contribute to, I'll give to that too. That will be my 5th contribution. Bernie Sanders, he's been terrific. a real inspiration. But I'll say two things, one about him and one about us. One of the reasons he's able to do what he's done, it's because for 40 years he tried to stake out a place in the mainstream spectrum. He didn't go over the top or over the cliff. And so he staked out that place, staked out that place. He always watched which ways the winds were blowing, which you have to do in politics. He waited, he prepared 40 years for this moment. No, he did. He did. I mean, it's no joke. If you listen to, like, the former governor of Vermont, Cunin, I can't remember, Madeline Cunin? She said, oh, yeah, Bernie. He's been saying the same thing since the 70s. He says it again and again. Yes, he did say the same thing. But he never went over. He never went over. And now it's the same message to us. If you listen to what he says, Bernie, he always starts out. I've read every one of his statements. Not that there are that many, but I've read them.
They're all the same.
No, they're not actually all the same, but they're pretty close. They're pretty close, I'll agree. He always starts out by saying, you have to recognize Israel. You have to recognize Israel. Once you recognize Israel, we can talk. But if you don't recognize Israel, conversation over. Now, do you want to win over Bernie and his followers? Do you want to have a conversation with them? That's a step. Does a BDS platform do that? No, it explicitly doesn't. Explicitly does not do that. And then you have a question. Now, what do you want to do? You want to hug your principles, or you want to play this game they call it constructive ambiguity. I've never understood the meaning of that expression, but okay. Or are you going to do what international law requires of you to do, because Israel is a state under the state system, is a legitimate state. That's the law. If you want to appeal to the law and say the blockade is illegal under international law because it's collective punishment, if you want to appeal to the law and say the settlements are illegal because under Article 49 of the Fourth Geneva Convention, an occupying power can transfer its population to occupied land. If you want to appeal to the law and appeal to the law, then the law is Israel's state. So as a matter of not just consistency, though I do believe in politics, consistency has its place, which is another reason why Bernie has such a following. He's not a two-faced hypocrite. He's not duplicitous. But even as a political matter, you can't talk to Bernie unless you recognize Israel. That's just a prerequisite for having a conversation. Now, I was kind of surprised. I don't believe it, actually. I'm just going to say quickly, I read yesterday that it seems a rumor is now spreading that Bernie's going to make the Israel issue one of the issues he's going to fight for at the Democratic National Convention, that you're going to have to take a more even-handed stance. It's a great opportunity for him.
You have been listening to a recording of the panel discussion on Israel-Palestine taken at the Left Forum held at the John Jay College in May of 2016, featuring Tariq Ali and Norman Finkelstein. And that is our program this morning. Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. You will find us here at 90.3 FM every Sunday morning at 8 a.m. You can also stream us live on your computer at wzbc.org. Thanks for listening, and we hope you will join us again next Sunday when we will continue the broadcast of the Israel-Palestine panel at the Left Forum held in New York City in May of 2016. That is next Sunday on This Week in Palestine. You are tuned to WZBC 90.3 FM, Newton, Massachusetts. And this is John Roberts wishing you a good morning.